Support for WPR comes from UW-Superior Center for Continuing Education, offering Conversations on Living Alone, a three-part series beginning Wednesday, April 17th via Zoom. Details at uwsuper.edu. Support for WPR comes from Focus on Energy, committed to helping Wisconsinites focus on the planet by making smart energy choices. Energy resources for Earth Day and every day can be found at focusonenergy.com.
Good morning. 7 minutes after 6 o'clock, John Munson in for Joy Cardine on the Ideas Network. All right, here's a question for you. What do the Creation Museum in Kentucky and your local Whole Foods market have in common? Well, according to my guest this hour, the answer is pseudoscience. Whether they're buying probiotics or avoiding GMOs, he says, while many Whole Foods liberal customers might decry creationism or climate change denial, they still subscribe to plenty of unscientific beliefs at the dinner table and beyond. My guest this hour is Michael Schulzen, a freelance writer who focuses on religion and politics. He lives in Durham, North Carolina. He is the author of the Daily Beast article, Whole Foods, America's Temple of Pseudoscience. Michael Schulzen, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thank you for having me.
So why exactly do you compare Whole Foods to the Creation Museum in Kentucky? What do these two places have in common?
Sure. So as part of my work, I often cover creationists, and I often visit places like creation museums. And something that struck me is I'd go to these places, I'd talk to these people, and then I'd go back and go shopping, and I'd end up seeing a lot of the same things or a lot of the same type of pseudoscience that disturbed me so much in one place, but for some reason wasn't bothering me when it was in the grocery aisles of my local Whole Foods. And so something that I started to wonder was, why is it that one of these bothers me, but one doesn't? And something that you definitely see if you're walking down the alternative medicine aisle or going through the tea section, is you're going to see a lot of claims at your local Whole Foods which use scientific language and use scientific-looking packaging and medical type of things in order to make claims that really aren't scientific.
Yeah, you point out, you take to task the homeopathy section of Whole Foods, with which you describe as having plenty of Latin words and mathematical terms, but diluted remedies.
Exactly. Yeah. So this is a pretty classic example, which is that a lot of homeopathic dilutions, the idea is that if you take a substance which would otherwise be toxic and diluted enough, it'll end up having beneficial effects. And I want to emphasize this works for some people, or some people find this effective for them, and I really do respect that. But to say that it's a scientific tool is really pretty misleading. I mean, you can certainly go online and with no trouble find people who are writing scientific sounding papers or using these Latin terms and mathematical terms in order to sort of give an appearance of science to something that's not. And that's definition pseudoscience.
And you also take the paleo diet and coconut oil to task. No science behind those either?
I think that these are really broad areas, and I think that something that's difficult is you can find particular scientific studies to support specific things. Something that's interested me after writing this article is that the people I've gotten the most pushback from have definitely been paleo folks, so people who are into the paleo diet. And the way that they're responding to me is it tends to be, they'll sort of send me a list of facts and studies that have sort of been curated from various places and sort of throw them at my feet and say, well, what do you say about this? And I certainly respect that, that it can be an effective diet for some people, and that there's a huge range of ways that people talk about paleo, just as there's a big range of ways that people talk about coconut oil. But I think saying that something is the coconut oil miracle, or that we've found the ideal ancient diet, I think that's pretty misleading.
So why do you think there's so much demand for these products anyway?
Well, I think they offer things that it's a great question, and something that I've thought about a lot. And I think that part of it is that there's really a demand for things that medicine can't offer, which is this sort of simple, explicable, immediate solution, which I think for a lot of us it can be really confusing when we go to the doctor's office or read studies that disagree with each other to try to sort of parse through that. And I think a lot of the dieting and health advice we get, it's even when it's sound, it doesn't necessarily have something like a clear story or a clear narrative. I mean, something about homeopathic remedies is they tell a very particular story about the way that the way that poisons and, you know, when diluted can sort of have these other effects. There's a little bit of a narrative there. I think paleo diets tell an absolutely fantastic story about the history of the human body and our sort of fall from this dietary Eden and then our, you know, our coming back and rediscovering this ancient perfect diet. In a lot of cases, you see that language. And I don't know, I think as long as those types of stories exist and as long as mistrust of authority of all kinds exists, and you're going to see mistrust of scientific authority, as you'll see mistrust of any other kind of authority, I think we're definitely going to get a strong market for products which maybe are a little bit pseudoscientific.
And at times, you say the pseudoscientific slips actually into sort of a quasi-religious and anti-scientific. Is it anti-scientific or just anti-authority?
You know, I think those two things are so entangled, they're really hard to peel apart. And I think that's something that in our conversations about science in the United States, we often forget, which is that anti-science and these sort of anti-authority types of rhetorics really are so hand in hand that they're a little bit hard to separate out. So I think it's both, and that in many ways they're often the same thing.
And I guess is Whole Foods, is the pseudoscience you say that's represented here only a liberal problem?
No, I mean I don't think, you know, I don't have the data on who shops at Whole Foods. I can certainly say that from my own Whole Foods in Durham, just judging by the demographics of Durham, which is an overwhelmingly liberal city, I'm going to say that probably most of the people there, certainly most of the people I run into there, are liberal. And I would say that's probably generally something that you're going to see at Whole Foods. But I don't have those numbers. I obviously can't prove that. And there are people using these remedies and worrying about, you know, I'm worrying about a lot of these things, certainly from all parts of the political spectrum. I think the main thing that I want to get across is that I actually don't think this is a liberal or conservative thing. I think pseudoscience is a much broader phenomenon, and that we tend to get sort of trapped in these right-wing versus left-wing, religious versus non-religious kind of culture war dynamics when we talk about science in the United States, even though really it's something that we find all over the political spectrum.
Well, you do talk about some of the religious aspects of this. Ezekiel 4:9 bread, Dr. Bronner's magic soaps,
absolutely,
sacred healing food. I mean, there does seem to be a religious aspect to this.
Yeah, I think absolutely. I mean, I think we surround the way that we eat with a whole lot of things that seem, I'm not sure I'd say that it's a religious ritual, but things that sound sort of ritualistic or that tie in to these larger ways of thinking about the world, absolutely. And you see that in Whole Foods products, and you see that just in the way that I think a lot of people talk about how they eat or organize how they eat. And you do. I mean, there is a history, absolutely, of religious movements that get tied up with food. So Seventh-day Adventists in particular, I believe that the Ezekiel 4:9 bread, for example, is from a company that's owned by Adventists. So you definitely see you definitely see religious movements talking a lot about how do we eat healthily, what are our responsibilities to eat in a healthy way. And at the same time, you see healthy eating, I think, sort of often be people looking for a miracle. And sacred language and miracles, obviously, you know, they go together.
Sure.
We
need to take a break. When we come back, we've got some Facebook comments. I think we're probably going to have some phone calls shortly as soon as I give the number, which I will do right now, 800-642-1234, 800-642-1234. We're talking about, do you follow the paleo diet, or do you consume probiotics, embrace homeopathic medicine, or do you agree with our guest position on these things that there's some pseudoscience involved here? Let's hear from you, 800-642-1234. Michael Schulzen is my guest. He's the author of the Daily Biz article, Whole Foods, America's Temple of Pseudoscience. I'm John Munson in for Joy Cardine. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Whole Foods, America's Temple of Pseudoscience. That's the title of an article by Michael Schulzen, a freelance writer who focuses on religion and politics. And that's what we're talking about this hour. On the Ideas Network, I'm John Munson in for Joy Cardine. We have a comment from Barbara on Facebook who writes, when our very own FDA is not bought and sold by Big Pharma and Monsanto, then I will happily buy regular meat and produce. Homeopathy is a widely used, accepted, and is standard science in many parts of the world. Just because a study originates outside the realm of the USA medical community does not make it illegitimate. Michael Schulzen, what do you say to Barbara?
Sure. So one thing that I want to emphasize is that if homeopathic remedies work for you, or if you find them effective, I think that's great. I'm not trying to tell people that, you know, you shouldn't have this or you should have this. But I do think that, and I think that there's absolutely valid concerns to have about the FDA and thinking about how it is that we regulate food and how it is that we regulate other things. As for organic meat and produce, that's fine. At the same time, I do want to emphasize that, I think that this type of distrust of the medical establishment and of the scientific establishment, although we should approach everything with a critical eye, I think it's a little bit unwarranted. And I think that's really exactly the type of concern about authority that I was talking about. And I think this is in many ways a question for the medical community and for scientific communities to try to understand, and for anybody who exists sort of in between those and the public to try to understand why it is that that type of skepticism exists. You know, medical tools and scientific tools are remarkably powerful, and although I certainly respect this commenter's, you know, concerns, I do feel like she would probably go to the emergency room if she were feeling sick or needing that type of medical attention. I think that would be where she would go.
Well, one of the things you reference in your article is the anti-vaccine movement and how doctors are now saying, congratulations, you brought back the measles.
Right. So this is a really serious question. And this is the issue of where these types of pseudoscientific conversations and where this type of scientific skepticism, which I think thrives at a place like Whole Foods, this is where that bubbles over into the type of political conversations which should worry us. Some pushback that I've gotten for this article is people saying that the comparison between creationism and something like Whole Foods is really unfair because creationists are trying to force these agendas often in the public sphere. And to that I would say that, you know, some creationists do that, and most probably actually aren't trying to force those on other people. And that exactly this type of, you know, this type of medical skepticism that we see, although it's typically a personal belief, which, you know, I wouldn't want to say is something that I'd want to necessarily strike down out of hand. It can bubble up into these types of things, which affect us all as a society in a really scary way.
Mm-hmm. You brought a biologist to the probiotic section of Whole Foods. What did she say about the products there?
Her general take was that probiotics have an enormous potential for human well-being right now, but that very little is known about how they work and how they might be effective. And that I think her main concern was that the claims that the probiotic bottles were making were for the most part just completely unsubstantiated or really hard to substantiate. And the way that they were throwing around numbers of bacteria that were involved and the way that they were sort of throwing around this data, I think she felt was dishonest. She used a more colorful term, but
we won't say that on the air.
Yeah.
Not even at 22 after 6 in the morning would we get okay. away with that. What about GMOs? Why do you call a Whole Foods campaign against them overblown?
So, yeah, that's a great question, and this is something that this could sort of be the topic of a whole other conversation. And I think there are definitely valid concerns to have about GMOs as well. And something, you know, I don't want to make it sound like we shouldn't be talking about this or that all GMOs are fine, but the way that Whole Foods has handled GMOs is they walk this very delicate line. They've partnered with the Non-GMO Project, and the way that they speak is in the sort of language of, well, we want you to be able to make an informed choice. But the informed choice that they seem to be pushing is increasingly towards simply rejecting GMOs out of hand. And this sort of knee-jerk, all GMOs are bad reaction is not only tied up, I think, with some pretty pseudoscientific ways of thinking about the world, but also has had some pretty detrimental effects. A classic example would be golden rice, which is a genetically modified rice, which has the potential to save millions of lives in the developing world. And there's been this enormous pushback by GMO opponents against this golden rice, really as this kind of knee-jerk reaction to something, instead of really thinking through the evidence about this and determining whether it might be something worth trying out.
800-642-1234. That's the number to call to join the program. And Michael in Plymouth has done just that. Michael, good morning.
Good morning. Yeah, I had a question. He mentioned a couple of times that some of the pseudoscience is that taking a toxic chemical in a diluted form and expecting it to be good for you. That's how he defined the pseudoscience in that. And I wondered if he, I mean, chemotherapy, it kind of sounds like the exact same thing. So would he consider that pseudoscience also?
Yeah, thank you so much for that question. No, I would not consider chemotherapy pseudoscience. I should have spoken more precisely. So homeopathic remedies use a very particular way of thinking about toxins that are diluted to the point where if you buy certain bottles, in your store, there'll actually probably be no molecule of that substance in there. This is very different from something like chemotherapy, which is being measured out, and it is a toxic thing, which is having a positive effect. Or can have some positive effects on people. But it's just a totally different way of thinking about evidence, about thinking about chemicals, and about thinking about how these things affect our body than these remedies.
800-642-1234. talk@WPR.org is the email address, and you can also post to the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page and leave your comment or question for my guest there. Thanks for that call. And you could be next, 800-642-1234. You also have no love for Whole Foods' organic integrity effort, especially the way they label everything that comes in contact with conventional foods. What does the science say about organic foods?
You know, that's an area I really did not actually want to go into in the article, the specific scientific analysis of organic foods. It's a really contentious area, and it's one that I don't think I'm really qualified to speak on. So I don't really want to push into there too much. And the particular thing that I was talking about there is actually something that goes beyond the regulations that that the USDA places on organic foods. So this is a particular sort of initiative that Whole Foods seems to have launched at some point. Which kind of encourages you to take those same standards of separating organic and non-organic foods that have to go on behind the scenes at Whole Foods and apply those to your own life and to your own cart. I actually don't think of that as an example of something pseudoscientific, but I think it highlights the fact that we're a little bit neurotic and a little superstitious, perhaps, in the way that we think about our food, that we're really using this language of purity and thinking about thinking about purity in a way that to me sounded really nothing more like kosher law than like Jewish dietary law.
Well, like if you use a blade to slice a conventional loaf of bread, you shouldn't use it to slice the organic loaf of bread.
Right, and I mean maybe there is evidence out there that says these crumbs are going to pollute these crumbs and it's going to be really damaging for you. But I really think this speaks to instead this strong desire that that we can have to separate out things of different kinds. And I mean, I'm Jewish. I'm familiar with kosher law. I certainly understand why there might be a desire to separate out things for reasons that we don't totally understand, beside that we feel like we should separate them out. But I think it's interesting to at least note that this is something that's happening. It's happening in Whole Foods as well as in a synagogue kitchen. So,
sure. Here's a comment from Renee on Facebook who writes, I've tried the fad diets like Atkins, paleo, gluten-free, but at the end of the day, it's not what specifically I have been avoiding or adding. It's what I've just been eating better. But to read the websites promoting it, they will swear that you must avoid dairy, gluten, bread, carrots, because our bodies aren't genetically engineered to handle it, which, when you say it out loud, is pretty silly.
Yeah, I mean, I think these diets, they're trying to sell a very particular kind of story and a very particular kind of easy path to eating well. I'm not a dietitian, but certainly from looking at these diets and reading them, that seems to be, their sales pitches, like any other sales pitch. And I think that they can help a lot of people, and I'm glad to see that. But yeah, absolutely.
Let's take a quick call before we get to news time here. Nathan is in Horicon and joins us this morning. Nathan, good morning.
Good morning. How are you?
Good. Go ahead.
Yeah, I just wanted to make a quick comment. I watched a documentary on homeopathy, and one of the beliefs that they have is that diluting something actually causes it to be stronger medicine, and yeah, it's kind of ridiculous, and that's just my comment.
Nathan, thanks. Michael Schulzen?
Yeah, no, I agree that these particular ideas, there may be a way in which they make intuitive sense to some people, and I think we should respect that. But at the same time, yeah, I think probably diluting something to strengths that are so tiny that it's barely there probably doesn't make it stronger.
So what's the difference between creationists writing school textbooks and Whole Foods selling coconut oil books, for example? Is the influence on the public the same?
You know, I think with something like school textbooks, if they are adopted by public school systems, that's forcing that on, that's forcing that on kids in a way that's a little bit different from what Whole Foods is selling. At the same time, I think that they are similar in that they're both selling pseudoscience in the public sphere. And I think that we tend to react to them pretty differently because we think of Whole Foods as a company serving its customers, which it is, and we think about religious groups and ideological groups a little bit differently for good reasons. And for some reason, I think we tend to give a little bit more of a free pass to someone selling pseudoscience rather than to someone who seems to be promoting it for some reason that's not strictly commercial.
We're going to take a break and check the latest news, and when we come back, we'll have more of Michael Schulzen and with you, if you choose to join us, 800-642-1234, 800-642-1234, talk at WPR.org, or find the Joy Cardin Show Facebook page and leave your comment or question there. What do you think? Do you follow the paleo diet or one of those others? Do you embrace homeopathic medicine? Do you agree with our guest's position or do you disagree? Let us know. 800-642-1234. Our conversation continues in just a moment. I'm John Munson in for Joy Cardin. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Is Whole Foods America's Temple of Pseudoscience? Well, that's what Michael Schulzen wrote in an article for the Daily Beast, and we're talking about that with him and with you this hour on the Ideas Network. Good morning, John Munson in for Joy Cardin. It's 6:36. 800-642-1234, 800-642-1234. That's the number to call to join the program. You can also use the email address talk@WPR.org or do as so many have done already this morning. Find the Joy Cardin Show on Facebook and leave your comment or question there. So, Michael Schulzen, is there a way we can help people think more scientifically in all aspects of their lives?
Yeah. I mean, one thing that I think some people have advocated for is for people to think scientifically at all times in all aspects of their lives. And I think that's a little bit overblown as well. So I'm not saying that we should all become robots or Dr. Spock or Spock from Star Trek and start thinking in that way. But I do think that we could talk a little bit more about the methods that scientists use and a little bit less about just collecting facts. And this is something that I think is when I read pseudoscientific arguments, when I study creationism, when I'm writing about these other topics, this is something that I see again and again, is not so much an inability to gather facts together, but a little bit of ignorance about how it is that scientists organize information, the particular methods that they use in order to arrive at theories and work through these ideas. And I think that's something that we tend to talk about when we talk about thinking scientifically and making making decisions that are informed by data, is we just think about getting that data and wishing that people saw more data. But I also think it's important to learn how to interpret data and just sort of sort out claims that seem a little bit suspicious from claims that might be a little bit stronger.
Well, and it seems to me that, it would be a little bit of a red flag when you see, a headline on a web article, "Doctors don't want you to know about this." Like there's some conspiracy to keep healthy information away from you.
Right, absolutely. And I think that those types, that sense of conspiracy can partly come because when there's just a gap also between personal contact. I think something that's worth remembering is that probably most people don't actually get a chance to really talk to a research scientist or really talk to a doctor outside of very, very particular contexts. And I think it's easy then to think of these things as these sort of distant elites forming conspiracies when you don't necessarily get to see them day to day, right? I mean, I live in a city that is a major research center, and I am able to interact with scientists very regularly. But that's really just a particular quirk of the geography of where I live. And it's a little harder, I think, to think in those conspiracies when you actually know the people who you're alleging a conspiracy about.
Mm-hmm. Here's an email from Nancy in Janesville, who writes, I was living in Germany in 1991, and homeopathy was all the rage. I was doing physical work training horses, and my arthritis would bother me. One of the stable's clients suggested homeopathy to me with the caveat that you have to believe it will work. They were also doing homeopathy on horses, and I asked how they convinced the horses it would work. Well, thanks for that email, Nancy. Here's a listener on Facebook who says, everyone is biased in some way, even scientists. People are driven by a combination of reason and emotion. No one is fully informed or all-knowing, so all you can do is act on the best available evidence you have. The real danger is when you ignore the best available evidence and go with ideology or emotional decision-making, for example, fundamentalist religious beliefs or racism. Then you are acting irresponsibly, if not unethically and immorally. Michael Schulzen, what do you say to that?
Yeah, I mean, I think maybe there are cases in life where emotion is not the worst way to make a decision, but I certainly would agree with the sentiment of that statement. So
do we have to read scientific journals to understand everything we eat?
No, I don't think so. I think that, you know, a big issue here, and this is where we get to those delicate questions of authority again and again, is knowing a little bit about who to trust. So just to give one example, I had someone email me with a about the paleo diet after I wrote this article, and one of the things he said was, well, did you see the commenters on this article? I thought they really debunked the argument about paleo, you know, against paleo, you know, and he was talking about anonymous commenters on an article that had been written by a professional scientist working in a field. And there I do think it's fair to say you don't need to read the research and you shouldn't trust people blindly, but at the same time it might be worth considering, you know, do I trust the anonymous commenters more than I trust someone who is, you know, has devoted a career to studying these things and who is working within this very particular kind of method and system, which, although certainly imperfect, has been built over centuries to eliminate bias as much as we can.
Well, there really seems to be a cultural rejection of scientific authority over the last, say, 25, 30 years or so. I mean, when I was growing up in the 50s and 60s, scientists were the heroes. And, you know, they got us to the moon. They figured out how to get rid of polio. I mean, there were all these things that science was doing for us, and science was revered and respected, and scientists were venerated. And now, it's almost like the more scientific they are, the more we seem to not trust them anymore. Is this a cultural issue? And how does this trickle down into things like science education?
Yeah, I mean, that's really the million-dollar question, right, is why is it that we see this sudden uprise in skepticism about scientific claims and other things? And that's something that I wish I could, you know, I could throw out hypotheses, or I could throw out ideas for why this might be the case, but it's, you know, maybe if scientists were to send us to the moon again, we'd feel a little bit better. But yeah, I mean, it's a hard thing to grapple with. Certainly in the religious and fundamentalist sense, it's around the 70s that you start to sort of see this realization that that these scientific questions can actually become the grist to sort of a political mill, that they can become really valuable fodder for culture wars. And I think they sort of blaze this path of recognizing that science can be politicized, and that once it has been politicized and tied up with these questions of authority, it can be a really powerful political tool, and one that we see wielded really effectively again and again by politicians, especially on the right wing right now. But I don't think it's specifically limited to right-wing politics. I don't know if scientific education has changed all that much since the 50s in ways that would explain some of these shifts, but I do think that scientific education and science education is exactly something that we do need to be talking about. And I think that in many ways something that we tend to emphasize again and again in science education are the facts and the particular ways, you know, the particular things that science is finding. I seem to remember a lot of my science classes just being like long PowerPoint slides listing off again and again facts for us to learn, instead of talking a little bit more about the methods and the tools by which scientists analyze data and the particular ways that they're trying to eliminate bias and arrive at conclusions. the other thing that really strikes me is that we see a lot, we see this emphasis, I think, because these topics have become culture war topics, we see this really strong emphasis on creationism as like the one thing to deal with, instead of thinking that pseudoscience and its ilk can be a little bit broader. I grew up in the Bible Belt, and we would, at school we talked about evolution a lot. My teachers, really wanted to make sure the creationist students in the class knew what they were missing or knew what they were not, knew what they were opposing. But we never went to the grocery store, and I think that's really interesting.
800-642-1234, 800-642-1234. That's the number to call to join the program. We're talking about pseudoscience sort of in general. The launching point for this discussion was a Daily Beast article by my guest, Michael Schulzen, titled Whole Foods, America's Temple of Pseudoscience. We're going to take a break here in just a moment, Michael, but when we come back, I want you to talk a little bit about why we're willing to challenge creationism wherever it happens to pop up, some of us, but we don't similarly challenge Whole Foods or companies like it and on these pseudoscience issues. I want to talk about that when we return. 800-642-1234. We'll have more of your calls and Facebook comments and emails in just a moment. I'm John Munson in for Joy Cardine. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. This hour we're talking about pseudoscience with Michael Schulzen, who is a freelance writer. And his article titled Whole Foods, America's Temple of Pseudoscience is what sparked this discussion. So Michael Schulzen, why does Whole Foods and why do similar companies kind of get a pass? We don't really challenge them. Why is that?
Yeah, I mean, I think part of it is that we tend to give a free pass to commerce, that we sort of say, well, they're serving their customers and it's okay. And they are serving their customers and we have to respect that. But I do think it's still worth, they should get some scrutiny because of that. And then the other thing I think is that we just are so deeply attuned to this sort of culture war, us versus them mentality. I think particularly on the left, we really hear a lot that that pseudoscience and that anti-scientific attacks are something that's strictly limited to a particular fringe of the religious right. And I think that makes it a little bit hard for us to sort of look around and see that there's, in fact, pseudoscientific and anti-scientific things going on all around, and that there's nothing about this that's inherently right-wing.
Mm-hmm. Here's a call from Dan in Rice Lake. Dan, good morning. Thanks for being with us today. Go ahead.
Good morning. I just thought I'd call in and say, my granddad was born in the late 1800s, lived on a farm all his life, lived to be 96 years old, and he had 11 kids. Not a single one of his children lived as long as he did. Not one. And as a matter of fact, most of them didn't come within 15 years of him. And I would like to also mention, the media puts out stories that are 100% baloney to anybody that knows anything about statistics. For example, do you know anybody who does not believe that half of all marriages end in divorce? That was published after the census came out and said that year, that the 10-year period, the divorces equaled one half of the number of marriages that occurred in that time frame. That's where that story came from. They never took any account of the millions of marriages were going along blissfully at the time. They never took any account of people who got divorced and remarried. But everybody will spout that statistic. And it's baloney. Mm-hmm. I'll listen off the air.
Dan, thanks so much for that call. A lot of this has to do with our media environment. Michael Schulzen, what do you think?
Yeah, I mean, I absolutely agree. I can't speak to that specific statistic, although I'll certainly have to check it out. But I agree that the way that statistics are used in the media, and also the way that we're taught or not taught to interpret statistics, are definitely a problem. I think the fact that statistics is probably not taught as regularly or as thoroughly in many high school curricula as you might hope, and it is a really powerful tool. It's also a really powerful way to understand when someone is not being totally honest with you. But yeah, I absolutely agree that there is this sort of statistical misuse in media environments. Something I should add is that some of the things that I say in the article could apply to articles that have been published in the Daily Beast. So with all due respect to the magazine, I certainly think that, you know, this is something that we see across the media, of course.
Mm-hmm.
But we want to have a vibrant media conversation as well. So.
Is it pseudoscience to trust a journalist to inform us about the science of nutrition? I mean, doctors received no coursework or background in nutrition. It appears to be a field with limited expertise.
Yeah, sorry, is it pseudoscience for journalists or for doctors?
Either one.
Yeah, doctors, I'm not entirely sure. For journalists to give dietary advice, I think, is definitely dangerous, and I've tried to avoid that. I think I'd like to encourage critical thinking about dietary things, and I can point out when something seems like it's using language or using terms that seem a little bit misleading. I absolutely think that's a journalist's job, but I mean, I don't think it's a journalist's job to independently come up with better sort of dietary regimes. As for doctors, that's a great question, and I don't know that much about how medical education ties in, or medical education for general practitioners and other people who aren't specializing in this area, how that ties into nutrition.
Well, most reputable clinics have nutritionists on staff, and that's who you get referred to if you've got specific dietary issues. So, most doctors, I would think, if they're like, say, a general practice, internal medicine type doctor, would probably have some grounding in that. But that certainly isn't necessarily what they went to school for.
Yeah.
We've got some more callers, and I'd like to make sure we get them all in before the top of the hour here. Let's go to Mark in Rockton next. Mark, good morning.
Thank you. I am just profoundly unimpressed with the technical knowledge this particular writer has on the subject he's criticizing. There's a reason why Americans are opting out of the industrialized food system. They don't trust it. There's plenty of peer-reviewed, published research, much of it conducted by the USDA, that clearly illustrates the levels of toxic agrochemicals that contaminate our food. So people who are practicing what the regulators refer to in Europe as the precautionary principle are doing it for good reason. And whose science is pseudoscience, John? We've got a smaller percentage every year at our large land-grant universities like the University of Wisconsin, publicly funded and more funded by the biotechnology industry, Monsanto, DuPont, the agribusiness entities. And every time an independent scientist comes up with literature that challenges the orthodoxy, they are just jumped on. I'm going to give you one example. There's a food ingredient that's, quote, natural called carrageenan. It's from seaweed. Literature is conflicted. Published peer-reviewed literature is conflicted. When the Chicago Tribune asked the carrageenan and lobby group for coagulants in our food for any published research that said it's safe that wasn't funded by the industry, they couldn't come up with anything. And the industry, on the other end, all the public research that's funded by the National Institutes of Health says this material is dangerous. The industry attacks those scientists. So who are we going to believe? And operating under the precautionary principle seems to be a prudent approach to protecting ourselves and our families.
Mark, thanks. Thanks so much for that call, Michael Schulzen. There are some essential trust issues here, and these are some legitimate concerns, aren't they?
Absolutely. Yeah. I'm a little confused by the. I don't think that I'm specifically saying that you should or shouldn't, you know, opt out of the industrial food system. I think it's a little bit of a separate topic than what I've been talking about. I think there absolutely are trust issues. Something that I also mentioned in the article is that I wish that when we talk about pseudoscience in the United States, when we talk about bias and its relation to science, that we did look more at these particular sort of moves of industry into the scientific sphere. I think that sometimes we get distracted by these conversations about creationism and other sort of hot-button social, you know, media-happy social issues and miss some of the other things that we need to be talking about here. Absolutely.
Mm-hmm. Gary writes on Facebook, I am pleasantly surprised to see this show. People like to be cheerleaders for science, but they rarely seem to want to actually practice it. Can a show on the pseudoscience of catastrophic global warming be far behind? Well, I didn't really want to get into that this morning, but we want to cheer for science, but we don't want to practice it. What do you think?
Yeah, I think that our relation to science is often a little more fraught than we'd like to say, and that I think it's important to recognize, where we cheerlead for it, but maybe don't always understand or follow what's going on.
Mm-hmm. So, what's the big takeaway from your article? What is it that you really want people to remember? I mean, your headline, you have to admit your headline is pretty provocative. But what's the takeaway that you want people to bring from this?
Sure. I think the main takeaway would be that, or I guess the real reason that I wrote this article was that I was a little bit tired of seeing our conversations about science and anti-science and pseudoscience so tied up around very particular issues, creationism being in particular one that I think comes up far out of proportion to its importance in the public sphere, and that we also tend to talk about these things so often in political terms without being a little bit more self-critical and thinking that this is a broader problem. I think the ultimate takeaway is that what we need to be focusing on is the way that scientific education reaches people, and the way that we use data in our lives, and the fact that this is a really fraught process and that it's not something that's simply being completely done wrong by some other on the other side of the aisle, but that we've got it right. That we need to recognize that that all around us we're seeing these issues, and that if we look a little bit more closely, we can recognize that and start to really seriously think about how we need to talk about science.
Sure.
Education. Yeah.
But I mean, I think you would agree that there's a difference between homeopathy and, say, the anti-vaccine movement. Could we embrace one harmlessly without contributing to the other?
Absolutely. Yes, I think that you can embrace one harmlessly without necessarily contributing to the other. But I think if you are going to embrace one harmlessly, or feel like you're wanting to embrace, say, homeopathy, you need to ask, how does my embrace of this tie into anti-vaccine? What is my connection? How am I thinking about these issues? What do I know and what do I not know? I think that all of us are implicated to some degree. And my concern is not that some people are implicated and some people aren't, but that we're not self-aware enough of how we are implicated.
So we all have some homework to do, it sounds like.
That's the goal.
What was the reaction? I didn't look at the comment section of the article. What's the reaction been to what you wrote so far?
Yeah, so in all honesty, I've avoided the comments section of the article as much as possible. I'm told that that a lot of people think I work for the FDA, which I can say on the record is not the case. I've actually received a lot of positive response as well. People saying that this is something that they want to see talked about more. I think there's a hunger for conversations outside of these old, these old sort of culture war mudslinging dynamics. So.
Well, it's been an interesting hour. Thank you so much, Michael Schulzen, for joining me this morning. I really appreciate your time.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
Michael Schulzen is a freelance writer who focuses on religion and politics. He's the author of the Daily Beast article, Whole Foods, America's Temple of Pseudoscience. We had, Christy Taylor produced this program and handled direction for us this hour. Thanks, Christy. Robin Cherry handled on-air production. Appreciate her help as well. I'm John Munson in for Joy Cardine. More to come on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.